Hey, ladies and gentlemen, Scott Brennan again. Welcome to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. We are excited to be back with another great episode with two very interesting guests, but we're going to get to that in just a second. I want to talk about some of the sponsors on this podcast that make it possible, that we are very, very happy to work with. One of them, a woman by the name of Susan Robb, who's one of our sponsors, along with Paul Templer, the hippo attack survivor that's been on our show twice, and Kim Ward, another guest on our show, have launched the Nepal Outreach Program and really need your donations. Kim Moore, the executive director of the Templer Foundation, has a non-for-profit 501c3, has launched a GoFundMe page under the name Nepal Outreach Program. This program is designed to help specifically women and their children who are homeless. Their mission is to secure a house for the first 15 women and 17 kids and enroll each child in school this year. The first $3,500 raised goes toward tuition for the year for all 17 kids so far in a program and supply women the materials and tools to help them sustain the sewing program the Templer Foundation helped them start. Kim and Susan are appealing to their network and beyond for donations of any size to keep the worthwhile initiative alive. So please go to their GoFundMe page. Look up Nepal Outreach Program. It's a very good cause. We donated recently this week trying to encourage people to get involved. So go check Susan Robb out. Now, one of the sponsors on the podcast is the Adirondack Brewery, one of my favorite breweries. And just places in general. Go to Adirondack Brewery located in Lake George, New York. Now, coming this November to the Adirondack Pub and Brewery Sunday Brunch. Join them for their first ever Sunday Brunch at the pub on Sunday, November 12th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Adirondack Pub and Brewery has developed a completely unique and absolutely insane brunch menu that they're excited to share with you. Greek toast, huevos rancheros, breakfast tacos, shrimp and grits, and much more. No brunch is complete without Bloody Marys and mimosas. You can expect a wide range of breakfast cocktails made with local spirits right alongside their beer. Brunch is first come, first served. More information on their Facebook page. Also, they got pumpkin chunking coming out. Don't know what to do with those rotting pumpkins, those gourds you got sitting on your steps that the squirrels are getting at. Bring them to Pumpkin Chunkin', which is November 4th, this Saturday, from 1 to 5. The event is something for everyone. Apple slingshots, pumpkin catapults, bring your own pumpkin, giant slides, bounce houses, bonfires, food truck, performances from Bad Idea Entertainment, music, and much more. So bring them. Come launch some things at free entry. It was a good time. We went last year. We had a blast. That is the Adirondack Brewery, located in Lake George. Now, another brewery that we are happy to work with is Demented Brewing. Demented Brewing is located in Middlesex, New Jersey. One of the coolest tap rooms to visit. Has murals all over the place. Real demonic looking things. It's worth it just going to watch the art. But also the art is in that 16 different tap handles they have on tap to pour. Every Sunday they release something new. This Sunday they just released Beowulf, their robust porter on draft. Betrayal, their new Belgian IPA on draft. And Prominence, their Flanders Red Ale aged in Cabernet barrels on draft and in bottles. And Orcus, their Scotch Ale aged in peated Scotch barrels. That's four different beers, man. Gotta try them. They're awesome. This Sunday, they're going to be releasing Nightmare, their Belgian Dark Strong on draft. So go check out Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex. Give them some love on the Facebook machine. Manskirt Brewing is located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Manskirt Brewing located in the old bank building on Main Street there. They always have seasonally inspired ales, rotating tap handles. They have the St. James Men of Charity 9th Annual Harvest Fest in New Jersey Microbrew Night Saturday at 6:30. Go check them out. They're brewing all sorts of beautiful October, November type beers, fall beers. That is German style ales. That is Manskirt Brewing. Now, waking up with back pain? Are you waking up with back pain? Because 50% of Americans are. Sleep Ovation's new mattress is 700 tiny mattresses that individually cradle natural curves of your spine. So each one is just holding you up and absorbing you and just making, it's like sleeping on a cloud. You know, it provides perfect comfort and spine support for back pain relief and the best damn sleep of your life. I'm a terrible sleeper. These Sleep Ovation mattresses, fixing it all. It's great. So pre-order yours now at sleepovation.com. If you use the promo code VERBAL, you get $100 off your offer. So go check out Sleep Ovation. They're an up-and-coming company. Make a wonderful product. That is Sleep Ovation. All right. Today on the podcast, we have two very interesting people, two people very involved in the arts. One of them is Aisha Ash. She was a former ballerina, African-American lady, trying to really promote ballet in inner cities and get people involved and break stereotypes. And also Jonathan Lee Iverson, who was the first ever African-American Ringling Brothers and Barnum ringmaster. So just a very unique, interesting episode. Please keep subscribing. Please keep listening and enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Aisha Ash. I'm a former professional ballerina, currently doing the Swan Dreams Project, and you guys have been listening to Verbal Shenanigan.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, this is the last ringmaster, Ringling Brothers at Barnum & Bailey, Jonathan Lee Iverson, and you've been listening to Verbal Shenanigans!
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
And enter we do.
Yes, 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 yes. Welcome to another installment of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast.
175?
I think 173. I think we're at 173.
Okay.
Yes, 173.
Okay.
But welcome back. If you tuned in last week, you heard from John Lehrer, the Geico caveman, and Lewis Watson, who he was an English singer. Very fun episode, so go back and check that. But today you are joined by us. It's Halloween is over, Mike. Halloween is over.
For them.
Apparently, that's right. Your mic is off from the intro.
Yeah.
There you are.
Why'd you do that?
Well, it could be off permanently if you want. But so apparently Hollywood is also in a little bit of its own Halloween.
Halloween.
I did not even mean to say that.
Hack-a-lantern.
But it seems every day some kind of child molestation thing comes out or something with Harvey Weinstein comes out or there's someone who's been sexually abused. Hollywood seems like a very dark place that I'm not sure I really ever want to be part of.
It's one of those things where
I know you're thinking like
when you get
so close.
The thing is, when you get caught, you get scared, but then you say, "Okay, in 3 weeks, nobody's remembering me."
Yeah. So just today we're recording this. Kevin Spacey comes out gay, which is not the shocker. The shocker is that he uses it almost as a like, let's focus on the gay part, the fact that he probably hooked up with a 14-year-old boy when he was 25 years old or something like that.
26. I still can't believe he's Kaiser Soze.
Still getting over that one, buddy.
I know it was back
the
in
limp,
95.
The limp.
How did I not see it?
But
I thought it was the Baldwin brother.
Which I think is just absolutely atrocious of him. Not him being gay. Who cares? Like, it's the 21st century. And it's Hollywood. I imagine 95% of actors are gay.
You probably most of them people, you sit back, it's like, once you let go, it's so much easier for you. Come on now. Mm-hmm.
But I'd love him trying to, if I did it, I was drunk. Like,
I love that explanation. Okay. He's like, I don't remember it, but on the off chance that I did, I'm really, really sorry. I might have been drunk back then.
Yeah, it's like someone who gets arrested for rape or something. Like I was drunk. I didn't. It wasn't me doing it. Nah. It was my drunken self.
I keep you on a drunken self. You stop raping.
Sir, you robbed the bank. Oh, it wasn't me. Like what kind of
that awful, was poor me.
Awful excuse for him being a pedophile is that? Like, but I'm gay and I've had a relationship with men. Oh, oops, if I was drunk. we laughed. It was funny. Ew, you creep Kevin Spacey.
Still, I hear House of Cards is an amazing show.
Well, not anymore. House of Cards has toppled. From what I hear, that's it with Spacey. So I don't know if that's I never watched the show. So
I heard say it was a scene from The other show, the Dragons one.
Dragons?
Yeah, the other HBO show, drawing a blank.
Oh, the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, they have that all the time.
The Dragons.
What's the president doing on set? Just go with it.
But, yeah, the Harvey Weinstein thing is out of control. You don't know who to believe and who not. I mean, obviously this guy's a level 10 creep. But all of Hollywood is level 10 creeps because it's like apparently everyone knew about it. It's like, oh, yeah, that's what Harvey did, you know.
Well, it was the same thing with Bill Cosby. Yep. Like, they were telling jokes about Cosby, you know, drugging women.
It took Hannibal Buress. It took Hannibal Buress to, like, say it again, and then, like, everyone caught on.
Yeah, he did it on stage, and, like, Cosby was like, oh, how dare you get the lawyers involved, and all of a sudden it's like, uh-oh.
Yep. Now,
somebody looked into this.
Now, there's also several sides to this. Do you believe all the women that are coming out? Like,
No,
I don't either. I believe some of them. I think it's that traditional piggyback effect that's going on when something awful happens in the news. Like, oh, it happened to me. Like, let me see if I could cash in on this.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably several. No, these are just the women that are admitting this happened. Think about how many women there probably are that got big roles that don't want to admit that this happened. Like, that don't want to even be in the public with this.
It's just a terrible spot, and it took this long for women to kind of stand up and say, none of this, and now it's kind of, it's what's also kind of funny is other people who get kind of called out on it. It's like, oh yeah, it's cool. Sorry about that. You know, different time and all. Like, what was it? Was it Matt Damon or no? Affleck.
Oh, Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck. Yep. He got called out by somebody. Negan's wife. Negan's real life.
Oh,
wife. Not on the.
I'm trying to think. I'm like, doesn't he have like a couple wives and a room or something like that?
His actual wife came out and they like interviewed him. He's like, I'm proud of my wife for coming out. And they're like, well, how you feel if you met him? It's like, she's not making it a big deal, so I'm not going to make it a big deal. But
yeah. The more and more you read about Hollywood and the entertainment industry, it's just control and just the government in general. You hear all these conspiracies about child molesters running things, and there's a whole ring of like people who like molest boys and stuff like I don't ever want to be famous or in the entertainment industry, but I would love to do
I'd like to do that hit movie, you know, do it in Vancouver and then just retire back in
Jersey. I want like a cult hit like Clerks or something. But then again, Harvey Weinstein was behind that, I think, too. So
really,
man, something like that. He had some money in it, so I don't know.
Everything is dirty money.
But he I mean the guy is, I don't even know much about him, but then you read about him, he's involved in like a million things that we are all like, no, and it's just, I guess he's a financial banker, and we find out the power of money and fame, and also how desperate people are for fame.
Well, that's why so many people are like, that's Harvey. No, please stop grabbing my junk, seriously.
And then it also makes you wonder, which I don't think anybody's talking about, is so these people did this to get a part or whatnot, and then they gain power and get fame and whatnot. Did they reciprocate and do that to somebody else and somebody else and somebody else? And now they have power and they want to be in the movie. Well, if you want to be in this movie, you have to do what Harvey did to
it
me.
It sounds like,
you know,
a sick version of that push it forward thing. Now you got to do three pervy deeds to three other people.
I don't know, man. It's a sick place that I don't want anything to do with. But you just hear more.
Unless they want to do the Verbal Shenanigans movie, then we're all for it. And all
did you ever hear about Pizzagate? It's like a whole cover-up of, like, apparently this government place that was a pizza shop, and they molest boys in the you got to go look.
What?
We'll get into that in a different episode. That's a whole...
Yeah, that seems like something we can't tackle in 2 minutes.
Yeah, no. especially with a guest coming up.
Yeah.
Let's get into our first guest.
All right.
It's guest time.
All right, let's do this.
See, that almost sounded disinterested.
Well, I try the other stuff, and you're the Berlew.
I still got to make a soundboard of all you're like, oh, yeah. Ooh, all right, let's do it.
Oh.
Let's get cracking. So who do we got here?
We have former professional. At my best, at my best.
We have
the mummy.
What guest did you call the wrong? Oh no,
no.
Was it the poo guys?
Yeah. We're like, well, we weren't interviewing them at the time, but we were like calling them to set it up, and I call them like, hey, what's your name again?
Yeah, we got to call these scientists from this like fecal transplant place and
open biome.
Open biome, yeah. And Burlow's like, hey, Dan, or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah. All right, let's try this again. Who we got?
We have a former professional ballerina and part of the Swan. Start over. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Part of the Swan.
Yeah.
If you think any of this is getting cut out, you're crazy.
It's been a bad day, okay? All right.
Here we go.
All right.
Stop. Who we got?
We have Aisha Ash. She is a former ballerina, and she is currently running the Swan Dreams Project out of California. And we'll be talking to her about her career and what the project entails with bringing more kids into ballet.
Ballet. How do you think you'd fare in a ballet class?
I have zero coordination whatsoever. I still wonder how they do the whole tippy toe, hold up their entire weight.
Do you dance at like weddings and stuff, or you just
I go out of my way not to, and it's always somebody dragging me in. Izzy is uber Dan, so I know any kind of party or whatever, I will be going out to the floor, but I am one of those, yeah, I'm going to come out, and then as we get out to the floor, I wait for somebody to like, get in the way, and I kind of let go and walk in the other direction.
All right. Well, maybe you'll get some tips.
Oh.
Maybe this will change.
Hello.
Hey, is this Aisha?
This is she.
Hey, how are you? It's Scott Brennan and Mike Burlow here from Verbal Shenanigans. Thanks for giving us a couple minutes.
Of course. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we are doing great.
We're doing pretty good. She's chuckling already, and all we did was introduce ourselves.
She's like, oh, God, I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe I'm talking.
Kind of. I have to admit, I'm a little bit freaking out. Like, what's going to happen? What are they going to ask?
Oh, just lots of really personal...
Well, let's set this up for the audience. Now, we've had a few conversations back and forth, and I called Aisha, we kind of talked about it, and she was excited about it, but she brought up apparently some episode where we said the phrase, and I quote, these broads better get jobs.
Yeah, it was like, and it was so funny because I multitask continuously, and so I was multitasking again, and listening and going in and out, and I just heard these broads, I was like, oh my God, what have I signed up for? I was like, what is happening?
I'm not sure if we even figured out which
it's probably,
I have to find it. I gotta
probably
find
acting
it.
us acting like idiots, which is very common.
If we're good editors, we'll cut in that phrase right there,
but we're not. Find out which episode that is. We have to go back to that. So now that you're an actual broad, no.
goodbye.
No. So, where are we calling you from? You're in California right now?
I'm in Cali. I'm in Northern California, San Jose, Silicon Valley.
Oh, ooh. All right. So you're up on the tech then.
Well, I'm not, but my husband sure is. He's an engineer, so this is where it's at.
Now, Aisha, I guess we could start anywhere, but I guess it makes more sense here for you, for us to start at the beginning with you. Where did you get, or how did you even become interested in ballet?
It was by accident, to be honest.
Just seriously, like this podcast. I said yes, and I didn't mean it.
No, honestly, it's I started off doing like jazz, tap, lyrical, and I saw my sights for Broadway. That's what I wanted to do. And we just happened to have in our little, we called them back in the day, we called them little Dolly Dinkle studios. These were the small studios that did just jazz and the little recitals and competitions. And we had a ballet teacher come in It was a guest teacher, and she told my mom that I had some potential for ballet and that if I wanted to get better in jazz and tap and all the other forms of dance, ballet is the foundation. I should do it. I went to a ballet studio in my the one ballet studio I know of in my neighborhood, and kind of everything just went from there. I started, I went kicking and screaming. It wasn't something I was, you know, just in love with. I wasn't in no way, shape or form a born ballerina. And it just became more challenging. Jazz and tap and all of that became, was very easy for me. I was winning lots of competitions and that became very boring. And I, ballet was definitely something that was a huge challenge for me. And then it came a point in time where kids were auditioning and going away for the summers, because in ballet, that's what you do. You go away for summer camps. And someone had mentioned to my mother that as a woman of color, it would be very challenging for me to pursue a career as ballet, as a ballet dancer. And for me, that was enough. I was like, now I have to do it. And kind of the rest is history.
Now, it says here you started at 13 with ballet, which is pretty old for what I understand. What kind of disadvantages do you see? Like, how much are you behind when you start at an age like that?
Well, I wasn't. I mean, I was 13 when I went to the School of American Ballet. That's not when I started. When I started taking ballet seriously, I was around 10 and a half, 11, which for me was extremely late because, I wasn't someone that had a natural facility for ballet. Mm-hmm. And so I was really behind, and I had a lot of catching up to do to form my body, to get the turnout, and all the things that you need for ballet. So yeah, that's quite late, especially if you don't have a natural facility for ballet. It's very late. So I felt like I spent my entire career catching up.
No, why is that late? Like, what is it about ballet that, like, say, you know, like I coach soccer, like, and many kids don't start playing sometimes till they're like 11, 12, you know, sometimes they even start in high school and they're able to pick up like a sport. Why is something like ballet that have to be kind of, well, not have to be, but most of the time taken up so early?
It's because one of the things is, well, besides we have a very short career, but the other thing is that, you know, the way the body has to form. And so you want to start molding that as early on as you can. And it's, I mean, you've seen ballet there, you know, what we do with our bodies is quite extreme. So the older you get, things start to form and kind of set in place, and it becomes more challenging to get that flexibility. You also, at a certain age, have to start doing point work, which are those hard shoes that we're on our toes. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain age that you have to start getting the feet and the toes very strong to do that work. And the older you get, you start just lagging more and more behind in that. So the earlier on you can start molding that body and molding the technique, which is quite intense, the better off you are.
Now, when you started at the age of 13, and you get into these classes and whatnot, what is the reaction from the other girls in the class and the teachers and whatnot? You joining? Were you welcomed immediately? Were you looked down on, like, what is she doing here? Did they welcome you right in?
I mean, that depends. When you say 13 was when I went to the School of American Ballet, and I think, you know, you have to realize when it's one of the, you know, best ballet schools in the world. Uh-huh. And I think everyone kind of coming into those schools, most of them are kind of, or at least one of the best wherever they were.
Right.
And so then you get kind of the best into a little pot. And I think everybody's just freaked out. I think everyone just sort of arrives with sort of deer in headlights, like, okay, this is the real deal. And we're just ready to work and compete, or whatever it is that we need to do, whatever mind frame that you set up for yourself to get through, you know, your summer course or the year or getting into a company. So I think it's less of, you know, you walk in the door and it's, you know, heads, at least for myself personally, I can only speak from my own experience. I didn't see, you know, heads turning like, who is this? Why is she here? It was, you know, just fear, just fear of, oh my God, I'm at the School of American Ballet and the prestige of it all. And I think everybody feels that, no matter, you know, what race, socioeconomic background you come from, you walk in the door and there's a sense that I'm in an important place.
Now, when you started getting into it, as you were saying, how you went from the jazz and the tap over to ballet. How long did it take for it to be a love for you, or what was like the biggest struggle off the bat, would you say?
The love is movement. I always say, more than a dancer, I'm a lover of movement. And that just means, like, you know, I just love all movement, whether that's capoeira, tango, ballet, ballroom, jazz, tap. I'm fascinated with the body and how it can move and the things that the body can do. So ballet was just another form of movement for me, a very high level of movement. But for me, it was just, as long as I'm dancing, as long as there's music and I'm moving my body, I'm happy. And I chose ballet for, you know, one of the reasons being because of that challenge, not only technically, but also what it stood for. And for me, being a young girl living in the inner city, having been shipped out to a suburban school all my life, there was always this this issue of trying to prove myself or disprove any stereotypes that people had. And that was, you know, just a natural flow for me in my art. And so the challenge for ballet was not only being, you know, a Black woman in this very white elite art form,
right,
but I also just technically, you know, again, I didn't have this natural facility for ballet. There's some people, they're just born ballet dancers. They're just born with all the technical things that you need to have of ballet, that, you know, the turnout, the feet, the legs, the body. And that just wasn't me. I wasn't this cookie cutter ballerina in any sense. And so my entire career, I had to constantly look outside, whether it be Pilates or yoga or gyrotonics, and look at something, do something else to kind of catch up.
Hmm. Now, when you're going through this, like, who's your biggest backer? Is your family supporting you through all this? Are you at any point saying, I kind of want to quit? Or are you only pushing yourself, or is your family also being very supportive in the process?
My family was super supportive. I mean, my family, you know, the life of a dancer, I mean, any parent will know, or family member of somebody who danced, I mean, it's the whole family almost has to participate, whether it was driving me to competitions or recitals. So they were super supportive. They don't have dance backgrounds themselves, but they were definitely 100% supportive of me. But once I went away to school, it's all on you. Right. I mean, it's, you know, I was 13 years old living in New York City by myself. It's on me to continue to push myself. And I kept a lot from my family. I kept a lot of the struggle and how hard it was, or the, you know, the many nights I spent in my room just crying, like, this is just too much. I kept it from them because I didn't want them to know that, you know, I was always struggling. But yeah, you definitely, it's, you know, your faith, your inner strength, your inner circle of friends, and just digging deep down inside and, you know, just pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, and just getting through it day by day.
It's kind of interesting. Like, when we initially contacted you, the thought process was just try to find out a professional ballerina, learn more about the dancing, the profession. As I read up more, and as you've been bringing up in the conversation, there seems to be limitations in people of minorities being in ballet. Where is that getting pushed from? Is it from, like, the producers who try to say you don't have the look, or it just seems interesting to me. The first thought of where struggles might be with, like, race equality, your first thought would not be ballet.
Yeah, it's art, right? At the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
Well, it is art, but it's an elite art, and it's an old art.
Yes.
So for, you know, many years, you know, it was unheard of, you know, to have a Black ballerina, and, you know, there's tons of history and behind that. But, you know, with the rise of Misty Copeland, there's been a lot of attention on it, which is fantastic. But there's been, you know, so many others before her that have just been fighting, and we're so grateful for, that sort of paved the way for, you know, introducing one, and then, okay, we've seen one, okay, now we can see another and another and another and another. And so it's only been recently that there's been a lot of media attention around it, but it's been constantly, there's always been women there fighting this fight, trying to make a name for themselves in the ballet world, and showing that, you know, women of color are capable of doing it. Now, where it comes from, you know, you can't just put it all on, you know, the directors of companies or schools. It's It's also an audience and, you know, donors and people who not only see the ballet but give money to the ballet. And it's, you know, it's pleasing the audience and what they want to see. And I think for a while people were used to seeing one thing, and anything, it's hard. Change is hard, right? Change is hard if you're used to seeing, you know, one thing. It's, I imagine that the same thing was with sports. You know, the first female who did, you know, basketball, or, you know, it was just, it was hard for people to swallow because it was just something different. It takes a moment for, okay, now we're used to this. And we're hoping that it just becomes a time where, you know, you look, it's like, okay, why can't there be a black, you know, Swan Queen, or, you know, Aurora, or whatever, that you just don't even think twice about it.
Right.
And there's some people today that they never would have thought about it even in the past. Like, it's just, what does it matter? A ballerina is a ballerina. But it did make a big difference, and it was a big deal. And it's, I mean, to the, unfortunately, in 2017, we're still having this ridiculous conversation, and we have to talk about it because it still is a problem. And things are definitely changing. They're much better. For example, the School of American Ballet has a diversity and inclusion committee that I sit on. And that didn't exist when I was in the school. You know, the fact that they're wanting to have more, bring in more teachers of color, that didn't exist. I mean, as a student, that would have changed my world, having been a student in the school and seen a teacher teach the class who looks like me.
Right. That was leading me to my next. I want to ask you, so going through years and years of ballet and being like a prominent figure in the world, you just said you sat on the board, but I was going to say, do you guys do things to try to encourage ballet in inner cities and to kids who maybe can't afford classes or even the shoes?
Absolutely.
I was kind of curious about that.
Yeah, so there's lots of really wonderful, and I can't quote all of them to you, but there are a lot of wonderful organizations and that do exactly that. There's, you know, some that even go as far as like getting a van and bringing the kids themselves to the class because they don't have transportation, or providing free shoes and costumes for performances and free tuition to class. And I know some of the big companies like New York are in schools, like School of American Ballet and others, they do outreach where they go into, you know, the inner city schools, and they do we call it a lecture demonstration, where they do a small little performance of something. And then after they, you know, have question and answers with the kids, and, you know, maybe have the kids demonstrate something just so that they are exposed to the art. I know for myself personally, having started my own kind of nonprofit, it's not an official nonprofit, but I run it as such. I just haven't had the time with being working and a busy mom with two kids to make it official. But it is absolutely run like a nonprofit, that I go out and offer free classes to those who can't afford. I've taught classes at my daughter's school for free. I've worked with Girls Inc. in Oakland, California, and taught classes out there. So these are the things that I do for myself personally, to try to reach as many people as possible and to at least get them exposed to the art form.
When I think of ballet, I think about something being very precise and by the numbers, if you will, where it's a performance and it need to be like this. How much of your own self can you put into like a performance of a dance when you're on stage?
Oh, you can, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can't, you know, be all over the place and, you know, you're completely out of line because you're giving too much or... But yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it, and also depends the company. It really does depend the company. But for the most part, you want to show what you've got, you know, you want to show yourself and put yourself out there. And a lot of times, you know, that gets seen, and, you know, maybe the director will think, you know what, this is, you know, she's kind of too good for the quarter ballet, you know, maybe she should do a soloist role in this ballet. You know, I see her, you know, holding her own very well here. Yes, I mean, at the end of the day, it is a quarter ballet. You have to look, you know, you have to be in unison. You have to, there's uniformity to it.
Right.
That if everyone's leg is here, you can't put yours, you know, all the way up here, because that's what the ballet calls for. But I think as performers, there is this individuality that definitely comes out.
See, yeah. I would crowd surf if I was in a ballet. Yeah, I'd go to the next level.
We know.
Woo! I'm a ballerina.
I've had nightmares of that happening.
I had nightmares of Mike doing anything like that. I wanted to ask you, so ballet, I wanted to ask you about the audiences and how, if ballet is evolving into a more modern thing. You think of ballet, like I think of ballet, you can tell me I'm wrong, but I think of ballet as a show that people with money go to, stuffy white people. I see it very traditional and kind of maybe something like more, that was more popular years and years ago, or something that like I wouldn't know much about because I was never really exposed to it. But how is ballet evolving like now in the 21st century or the 20-teens, whatever we call this era? And what do you guys do to try to get in like a new audience, to try to get audience that, hey, I would never go to a ballet, and bring some of these people in and be like, oh, okay, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've been out of the game for a while. I'm retired. So, you know, as far as what they're doing inside companies now, I can't say for sure. I can only say what I've seen.
Right.
And I mean, this conversation came up even way back when, and when they started seeing, you know, the old donors are dying off and we need to bring, you know, younger people to the ballet. You know, how do we make that interesting? How do we keep that art form alive? Actually, people going to theater, you know, how do you keep that alive? And I know they saw like some companies, they were doing things like, you know, trying to, you know, collaborate with like hip hop artists and, you know, so there'd be like, you know, someone doing hip hop and then the other dancers are dancing, or even just the kind of music that they are dancing to. But, you know, ballet, I highly recommend that everyone go to the ballet because it's not just Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty and the Nutcracker.
Right.
It really isn't. I mean, and it's people get blown away when they finally go and, you know, see a lot of these amazing, you know, modern or neoclassical pieces. And they're like, I didn't even know that was ballet. Mm-hmm. And I just think that they are just fascinated and blown away by it. Just what the human body can do and the different kinds of music. Everything is just not in a tutu and tiara. And I think that's what, you know, blows people's minds. And so I know that, you know, as far as the people that they collaborate with or the type of music they use or whether it's, you know, costuming or there are ways to just kind of get a particular name out there or kind of music out there, or even the advertisements that are done now, you know, seem to be a little bit more hip and modern. It's just not, you know, a dancer in a tutu and a tiara making a pose. It's a little bit more young and modern, the advertisements that you see nowadays. And there's even dancers going and, you know, advertising for Puma and all, you know, fitness lines. And so that's bringing more attention to it as well.
Now, I wanted to ask you, one of the things a lot of people do know is the physical toll that ballet goes through. We all see the pictures of you guys standing on your toes, and we cringe, and we try it in the bathtub, and kind of slip and hurt ourselves.
Please don't do that in
maybe
the bathtub.
Maybe that was me. what kind of physical tolls did it take on your body, and what ultimately led to you retiring? Was it becoming a mother? Was it your body just couldn't do it much anymore? But what kinds of things did you deal with, and injuries and issues?
I was one of, I have to say, knock on wood, I was a very lucky dancer that I wasn't plagued with a lot of injuries. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, and a lot of dancers, you know, it will, you know, come to an injury pushing them out of the career, or their body just saying, you know, enough is enough. Unfortunately, when I retired, I still had a lot left in me. I retired early because I had lost my father to cancer. And I had lost a sister to cancer just before getting into the company. And then, so when I finally had lost my father, I was like, that's it. Like, I'm done. Enough is enough. And already having, as I stated before, having been behind and just the technique of ballet, the constant pressure of, you know, as any minority will tell you, you feel like you have to be not just as good, you have to be better than, feeling like I always had to work that much extra. I just didn't have it in me anymore. So I had left the ballet world thinking that I was just going to become some waitress in New York. And I had a friend kind of talk me out of that and ended up in Europe dancing. But so for me, it wasn't an injury that pushed me out. It does push out a lot of dancers. It's, you know, with New York City Ballet, I was working 6 days a week, almost 12-hour days. So it's, yeah, it's, it takes, you know, year after year after year after year of that schedule. It does take its toll. Having been retired, I can say when I'm not dancing, I actually feel worse than when, because I feel that the body is meant to move. Maybe not that extreme in that many hours, but I definitely feel much better when I'm in a studio and I'm moving my body instead of just, I can't just sit stiff behind the desk. Like, that just doesn't work for me. It doesn't work well. But yeah, the life of a dancer is short, and it's very taxing on the body, and many, many dancers get plagued with injuries. Now, I think that with that said, dancers are certainly getting smarter. There's a lot of cross training that happens. The physical therapy has just, it's so much better. So dancers are finding ways to prolong their careers more so than they did in the past. Now, whether they choose to dance longer, is that's also changing. I think people are retiring much younger because they are going to school part time and they get other interests, or they, you know, jump off and want to do Broadway, or, you know, I've seen dancers become lawyers, real estate agents, and just all a whole host of things. But yeah, back to, you know, your question, it is quite taxing, and I'm very lucky that, you know, it wasn't an injury that pushed me out.
See, I would like a lawyer to be, like, dancing around during my case. I think that would, you know, bring the jury around to me.
Lighten it up a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure, I didn't pay my taxes, but look at my lawyer, man.
So what if I killed somebody?
Yeah.
Look at that plie.
See what's happening here? See, this is exactly what
I'm saying. Well, as I was researching you, I see you're from Rochester, New York. And
that's right. Monroe County.
Yeah. And they show the pictures of you going around in your tutu as part of your
Swan Dreams project.
Yeah. I kind of want to ask you, you talked a little bit about you like breaking into ballet as a minority into that sex. Did you, when you kind of began doing that and tried to bring it back to your community, was it kind of the same thing to kind of bring people, no, embrace this kind of new dance?
Yeah. So I was always teased a little bit just because of, I was just different, you know, I was doing different things and I was out, you know, I went to suburban school, I talk different, I do different things, you know, I wasn't wanting to just hang out, and I was always busy dancing or rehearsal, or, you know, I had to go to some competition somewhere, some performance somewhere. But I think the interesting thing is once, you know, I decided to create the Swan Dreams Project, and I brought that back to my hometown. I was always regretting that I didn't have a video camera, because I think the reactions and what I heard people say was even more profound than the images themselves. Because people were just touched, and people, you know, for those who know Rochester, there's just not much, you know, so much has left. Kodak, Xerox, I mean, you name it. And so people are hungry, you know, because there's still, like, there's still such a nice art community in Rochester, and there's still so much talent there. And so people, when I came back, you know, they were just like, oh, it's so good to see positivity. It's so good, you know, just to not feel forgotten. It's so good that, you know, people who have left here and done something with themselves are bringing it back. And for me, that's, you know, my mother always said, you know, don't forget where you came from. And so that was really important for me. And it was really important for me to tell them that I'm actually from here, like the inner city. And that was one of the questions this guy asked me. He's like, where are you from? I said, I'm from here. What do you mean here? Like here, here? And I'm like, yes, like here, here, not the suburbs, like 5 minutes down the street here. And that just blew his mind. Like, I just completely blew his mind. That he just, how is it possible, you know, this ballerina who went on and, you know, danced around the world is like, is from my neighborhood. I didn't even realize we could produce that. And I think that is what's important. That's what's important for people to see, and that to remember to go back, you know, where you came from, and to show others like what you've become, and be proud of that.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about the Swan Dream Project. So where did the concept come from, and what can people like expect to see within it?
Yeah, so it kind of morphed into a million things. So, I mean, I guess it started, it's always
like a
kind
swan.
Of been my life.
Oh. Like Scott, I see what you did there. I see what you did there.
I'm here all night. I'm here all night.
So, you know, it's just always been, I think, my life of just kind of battling stereotypes. Since, again, being a kid from the inner city, I was shipped out to a suburban school. And so you would always get things like, you know, do you have a drug dealer on every corner? And what's it like there in the city? You know, I would get questions like, do you have grass? Do you have a front, like in your front lawn?
That's
do you have a front yard and
question.
Backyard? You know, and so, you know, you get, they're always, you know, the diff, I always, you know, put them in categories, which you should never do. But there were there was the group that chose to deal with that in anger. And they had every right to be angry and upset. And then there were those who chose to just like, I don't even want to deal with it. I just want to blend in, just become one of you. And we're all the same and kumbaya. And, I was kind of somebody in the middle. Like I just was, you know, look at me, judge me by my actions. You know, don't just judge because what you saw on TV or what you think I'm going to be, watch me and then make a comment. And so I was always just sort of like in the gray area, I feel like, and it seemed to work. It really worked. I kind of would show people a mirror. Like if they came to me with something very ignorant or racist or whatever, I always found a way to just kind of flip it back on them. And then they end up feeling really bad. And then I found that that changed them more than to come back with anger or just try to ignore it. And so I decided to use my art to do the exact same thing. You know, there's constantly these images of, you know, women of color, very stereotyped images, very vulgar or aggressive or loud or, you know, it's when you think of a ballerina, the first person that doesn't come to your head, or at least then, wasn't a Black woman. When you think of the Swan Princess, it's not a Black woman, or a princess in general. Even buying little sheets and things for my daughter was, you know, it was never an image that looked like me.
Right.
And I just wanted to show the world that, you know, we're not what you see on the screen, you know, and maybe some of us are, but not all of us are. And that there's many sides to us, like there is any woman, you know, that we can be meek and gentle. And we have the qualities to be a swan and a princess and a queen and a fairy. And I mean, all of this. And I think that's one of the hard things in breaking through the ballet community is just the stereotype that exists of women of color. They don't see them as a ballerina, not just because of our technique, but just how women of color are judged and stereotyped in general. And so I just wanted to use images because I was also retired. I wasn't on the stage. I couldn't do it anymore.
Right.
And when I had retired, I retired early, and I felt like I didn't see my fight all the way through. And I thought, what's the next best thing I can do? And I had remembered a photograph at the School of American Ballet of a Black dancer who was there before my time. Andrea Long Naidu is her married name now. And it inspired me. I would, you know, be done with the day and just feel completely depleted and I can't just go on anymore. I would see her image and just go, you know what, she did it, I can do it, you know? And, you know, she was strong and made it through, and she was all by herself, and I'm all by myself, and I can do it. And so that's what made me think of using photographs. And I thought, you know, what better way? I'm reaching a wider audience than I would just on a stage. I can put them and share them with many people, and maybe that'll empower someone the way that image empowered me.
Yeah.
And I decided to go back home and do that. And then since then, you know, I had this, you know, as an artist and a dreamer, I thought, oh, this, I can put them on billboards and I can put them on all the shop windows, and then realize how much that cost, and none of that happened. So
like, Start with stickers.
Exactly. And so none of that happened. I said, you know what, I'm just going to put a couple on social media and see what happens. And it was the reaction I got from social media. And it wasn't just kids. It was grown women who told me that the pictures just brought them to tears, and all of these stories of, I quit dance because it was just too hard to be the only one. And I was told, you know, my hair wasn't good enough, or this, my body, or this or that. And I just thought, wow, you know, I need to really do something with this. And I thought, well, maybe if I, and then people started asking me if they could buy the images. And I thought, well, if I put them for sale, maybe I can use this money and help other organizations. And at the end of the day, it was just me just giving stuff free and free and free and, you know, trying to save the world. But then since then, I decided to just offer, go around and try to offer classes for free and reach out to schools and communities if they need me to come and talk about my career, talk about the Swan Dreams Project, just to expose children to ballet. And I found that, even without me dancing, that was already really powerful. Like when I went to Oakland for Girls Inc., there were these young girls, they knew a ballet teacher was coming, that they were going to teach them some class, which happens often. They have yoga people and, you know, different fitness instructors coming out or people from different professions coming to speak to the girls, but they knew there was going to be a ballet teacher. And as they're walking in, one little girl said, "Are you our ballet teacher?" I said, "Yes, I am." And she just stood there frozen, like deer in headlights. She could not move. Like, she just couldn't believe that a Black woman was going to be a ballet teacher, was going to be her ballet teacher. And right. She was just frozen, completely frozen. And I think you don't know how that touched that little girl and what, you know, what image of even herself changed after that. So just even my presence alone and just the fact of telling people I was a ballerina and I did it for a career and I come from environments like you, and it's empowering for people. It's really empowering.
Well, I mean, that's such a beautiful story. I really appreciate you sharing that, but I want to follow up with like a lighthearted question now.
Okay.
Now, you being a professional dancer, I'm guessing you've gone to dance clubs before, am I right?
Like, I have. Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to see if either the two following happened. Either A, you've gone there with a guy and you found out he is unable to move and he's like one of the worst dancers on the planet, or B, somebody who's there who thinks their hot stuff is on the dance floor trying to show off to you, where you're just like, all right, hold my drink for a minute.
Dance showdown. Well,
okay, none of those have happened. One of the reasons is, you know, A, whenever I did go to a club, I always went to the gay clubs because I just wanted to dance.
Right.
And I didn't feel like I wasn't looking for anybody, and I didn't want anybody looking for me. And I just really wanted to just go and just dance and have a good time. And they can dance. So that was never the problem. But I the kind of personality that I have, I'm never going to show somebody up. That's just not me. Like that would just never happen. But, you know, I can say that my husband's going to hate this. But when we first met, we would go dancing. It's like, I just kind of wanted, especially if like my favorite song came on, I just wanted to dance. And he would get very, my husband is Sicilian, so from Italy, and he gets very jealous. And so he really didn't like anyone seeing me dancing. So he would just kind of box me in, and I'm like, no, let me dance. And it's not like I was throwing myself everywhere, but even just like one little movement was already too much. he just kind of cover it and like hide me in. So that did happen.
Oh. Now I wanted to ask you one more question. I don't know if it applies to ballet, but again, I'm going to go with what my image of it is. Mm-hmm. You know, you see shows about dancers or movies or about cheerleaders or models or basically women in general who are involved in something, and they're being told they're being very strict. So some man is telling them that their body is too fat or they have to stay on a certain diet, and their body with body image being like such a, you know, an important thing, and like a you know, we try now to really like accept people and promote a positive message. Did you get a lot of that in ballet? Like, your body's got to be this and you got to be a certain height and just all this kind of sexist body image thing. Did you experience a lot of that?
Well, I mean, that's ballet. I mean, that is ballet.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to get away with it. You know, I have to say that I was kind of somebody that, I when I was first told that I had to lose weight, it didn't break me down, because and it does a lot of people. And I don't say that because I'm hard. I say that because I knew the reality of it. I knew, I could see the mirror. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew that I didn't look like everybody else. I mean, even to, you know, I'd come home and, you know, my family thought I was like emaciated and dying, you know.
Right.
But I come from a different culture. But in the ballet world, it, you know, wasn't enough. And so, you know, I just knew that that's just part of the job. That doesn't, you know, mean it's right or, but I just, you know,
right.
Then I just knew that that was par for the course. And I just did what I had to do to make sure I maintained, you know, a certain weight. And I don't think it was ever perfect. Like I was never one of these people that had the perfect body, super mm-hmm. skinny and just everything was right. It was just a constant struggle for me. And I think one of the reasons was, you know, the part of me didn't appreciate, I mean, I appreciate that aesthetic for ballet, but then for just a normal day-to-day life, I was mm-hmm. like, I don't want to be that, you
right,
know?
Right.
And so I would have this battle back and forth with myself, like, well, I'm a dancer, so I have to be that. And then there's the other part of me like, but why do I have to do that? And I would just constantly fight back and forth with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And besides the fact that just, you know, extreme dieting, just, I just really was terrible at.
I just couldn't do it. Just what like young girls go through, mm-hmm. like, you know, just, maybe it's something they would love to do, but some of them might just be, you know, holding back or shying away from getting involved in certain dance just because of their bodies and whatnot.
And I have to say that every company is different.
Right.
You know, there's every director has, you know, the aesthetic that they're looking for or, you know, the requirements that they have for their dancers. And so I wouldn't shy somebody away just mm-hmm. because of that. I mean, because you just never, you're closing the door on opportunities that may be still for you.
Right.
And so, yeah, if any young dancer came to me and, you know, said that they didn't want to because of that, I wouldn't shy them away. Now, the reality of ballet, it is what it is.
Right.
Right. It's just, it is what it is. And there's, you know, it'll be a long time probably before that changes, but and there are always, you know, always exceptions to the rules, but yeah, there's an aesthetic for the art form as far as even just, you know, the requirements that you have to be able to stand on point, you have to have, you know, feet that at least somewhat arch so that you can get over on your shoe. I mean, mm-hmm. there's just things in ballet that just have to be there.
Right. Aisha, I want to thank you so much for your time. Very insightful mm-hmm. points and really cool stories and whatnot. Where can people go to check you out or say hi? And hopefully we didn't freak you out too much.
No.
Is she off the phone? I want to talk about broads again. Yeah.
Don't worry, the broad segment's
you
next.
You better not. You'll send some hate email your way. So I'm just kidding. I would never. No, so this Swan Dreams project that I have, and you can go on Facebook and just Aisha Ash. You can just Google and find a ton of stuff. If you just put in my name in Google, you can find me on the swandreamsproject.org. I have, you know, as of late, I've, you know, since retiring, I've gone off and went through my Pilates certification. So I do fitness work as well. And so I'm on Instagram and even on, Facebook with my, it's called GraceFit with my GraceFit stuff. So there's quite a few places that they can find me.
Awesome. Aisha, thanks so much. And good luck with everything you have going on in the future here.
Thanks a lot, guys. This was fun.
Absolute pleasure.
Yeah, that world is just so foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything I did as a kid was like brute force and sports and no grace at all. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't imagine learning that.
Well, if you remember, as like time went along, a lot of athletes saw how the different muscles from doing that kind of stuff, and they kind of looked at going into it. Remember Walter Payton? He was a ballerina. He practiced it a ton.
I remember like the 80s, like in early 90s, a lot of like teams, like seeing guys in clips with like, you know, on the with the ballet poles and like mm-hmm. stretching on them and stuff like that. But very insightful. I couldn't help but think when she was talking about that. I know one of the problems with like with golf is having a very hard problem attracting minorities and inner city kids and even like a lot of youth in general to get into the sport because it's one, it's so expensive,
mm-hmm.
and two, it's very stuffy and elite and it's not advertised to kids and just to have a set of clubs or get. So that's what I was thinking about
and
the whole time.
And it's kind of sad if you remember, like everybody when Tiger Woods came out and said, all right, this is going to be the step to bring different cultures into it and getting excited. And it didn't really do it. It was kind of weird why it didn't happen, because he was the hugest thing in the world. He was literally the number one athlete in the world.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, golf, you think of that. Tennis, you still think of it having a problem, you know, like... Other than the Williams sisters, you know, I can't think of many black males that play that are professional tennis players.
Arthur Ashe was the only one that comes to mind,
right? Like modern, you know.
Yeah,
like
I know what
we
you
would
mean.
Know. We would know if ESPN just, came on. Like, yeah. Oh, there he is. So it is interesting, like that. Those, you know, decade goes by. Decade, you don't see an influx of it. Hockey, hockey, I would say, is getting better than it was in the past. It used to be like, that was the running joke. It's a white boy, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a white boy sport, you know.
Yeah. Which, NASCAR is struggling in that, too. They only 100%. Have one driver of African-American that has any, and he's looking for a ride right now.
Yeah. He's looking for a ride?
Bubba Wallace, he used to drive for Roush Racing, right. The same one that Trevor Bayne does. He drove for their Xfinity team, and basically they didn't have enough sponsorship, so they ran half a season and they basically stopped racing. So he got to get into the 43 car, Richard Petty's car, for a little while, and the big rumor is he will take over that car next year. But still, he's an accomplished driver. He won a couple races in the truck series. He had good finishes in Xfinity. He didn't get the win, but he had good finishes, and he was, like, in the top 12. He would have made the playoffs if they had money, but they had no money, so he had...
Be probably, like, a way better driver than, like, Danica Patrick.
I'd probably say... I mean, I'm not going to rag on... Danica could... if she got... Her big thing is she just didn't advance in NASCAR.
Right.
I could still see her doing decent in a super speedway, but a lot of teams can do good in a super speedway. I just never seen her in the 1.5s, which is the majority of the tracks, or the short tracks, where it's like, okay, Danica can do something here.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to, like, there has to be programs that go in and do this stuff, offer some of the stuff for free, like offer classes and get in there with equipment and stuff. Because all the sports we just named, it's a lot of equipment. You need court time or this time. And whereas, like, you know, the certain sports, you don't need that, and you can excel at. So I don't know. But I don't know how it's going to change.
Nope.
Hopefully.
I was really hoping we were going to change the world today, but I guess not.
Listen, we change the world one podcast at a time, buddy.
Oh, okay.
Now get your ballet shoes on.
All right.
Then I would love to see you attempt that.
When my back is better, we will play around with it.
The cramps that would occur.
Why are you eating 8 bananas? And I'm not going to do it this time. Scott's not going to get me.
We've talked about this before, but the Halloween season it's just passed. Maybe it's still here for a couple of days. Some people hold on to it, and now, you know, we're going to see the Christmas season roll around. It's probably already in stores, but
screw you, Thanksgiving.
I've said this before: the Christmas season, music-wise, which we know that you love Christmas music, with a mom who played nothing but Christmas music. The Christmas music market is done. Like, maybe there'll be one hit here and there, but there's so many they can. The same songs have been played forever, and you have enough where stations can play full days. So that's done. Like, I would not want to tap into the Christmas market, even though one day, during the Christmas time, we'll have to dissect me and my buddy's Christmas album that we made. Like, it was kind of a joke. But the Halloween market is wide open.
It's bare, pretty much.
It's Monster Mash. No one likes the Monster Mash.
No.
Do you really like the Monster Mash? Like, play the Monster Mash. And then, like, two songs in, it's like two minutes in. Dracula was drilling. Did I tell you about the comedy show I did where, was that a year ago already? I think it was. It was like Halloween time this year. It was one of Rocco's show at Triumph Brewery.
Okay.
And the opener was like some guy, like, who sang the Monster Mash, but I guess he brought a lot of people. So he did, but all he did was do like an acting out of the Monster Mash.
Wow.
Yep. And so I went on stage and I'm like,
So that happened.
No, no, no. I looked at because then he went back in the audience. I guess he brought like 15 people, so that was his thing. I just looked at him. I'm like, dude, the Monster Mash? Really? That's your thing? And like, I asked his wife. I'm like, is that what like he does in the bedroom? Like, Dracula is coming in the bed tonight. And like, he was so embarrassed. But it was weird. It was weird. So far in my career, I've followed a jug band.
Mm-hmm.
I followed a Monster Mash guy.
All right.
Played at a pizzeria. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going well. But the Halloween song is wide open.
Mm-hmm.
Monster Mash, Thriller, and Purple People Eater is all I can really think of.
And I don't even really think of Purple People Eater. It's yeah. like a true Halloween yeah. song.
It was funny. The other day I found one called... one of my students was singing Spooky Scary Skeletons or something like that. I'm like, what is that? I found this old song from Disney, and then I found like a remix of it, so I played it for the class, like, mm-hmm. and they were going nuts. But you sent me a whole list of songs that have kind of, I guess people have tried to get into this Halloween mm-hmm. market.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a sequel to the Monster Mash.
There's the gentleman who did it, he basically kept on trying to hit that Halloween market.
Halloween funny bone?
Yeah, Bobby Pickett was his name.
Is he still alive?
No. He died in 07.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, he missed out on Verbal Shenanigans.
R.I.P. Bobby. So
he goes to hell and he just hears his music all the time. God damn it.
Damn, this sucks.
What was I thinking?
So he tried to like capitalize on him doing the Monster Mash over mm-hmm. again. So he made the Monster Rap.
Yeah, that was his follow up to the Monster Mash.
All right. Well, let's hear. Why don't we hear a minute of it?
Sure.
All right.
Okay. Kind of familiar. Now there's some drums. Oh. This is so 80s.
In the lab late these nights, my eyes grown used to eerie sights. I created a monster who could dance and walk, but I couldn't teach him how to talk. My faithful assistant, that hunchback fool who wastes his time in DJ school, says,
Master, get him! Don't be a monster!
You've got to shock the body.
I hate this man.
Shock the body. Shock the body, body. Shock the body. Shock the body, shock the body, body. Shock. Igor, you idiot.
I'm done. I hate this man.
Basically, the same setup. You only change it. It's every white person and go, I'm going to make a rap song.
I hate his stupid voice. I hate his stupid rap. I hate his, oh,
shock the body.
Igor, you're so dumb. Like, shut up.
Shock the monkey.
I hate that man. Mr. Pickett, I don't. Care
so you won't go to his gravesite in Creve?
No, it is 2017, 10 years.
He died this night.
10 good years. Then we have DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Nightmare on My Street. I'm sure we've all heard a little bit of this one. Maybe. I know this one.
Mm-hmm.
Like the beat already.
Yep.
They had the Christmas one, too.
I don't remember that one. Bunch.
See, this one's got a little, like, I want to nod my head to it, and I'm not annoyed by, like,
now I
must
have a story that I'd like to tell about this guy. You all know me, and we're scared as hell. He comes to me at night after I call into bed. He's burnt up like a weenie, and his name is Fred. He wears the same hat and sweater every single day. And even if it's hot outside, he wears it anyway.
He wants to tell about a story about a man that visits him in bed. Day man. All right. Here's another second of this.
But he shows up when I'm asleep. I can't believe that there's a nightmare on my street.
It's bad, but it's not that bad.
Not tragic. Hi,
you're creepily like holding on to the light there. But it's not tragic. It's not like the last song. Like, Boogeyman was drawing on a bed in a boo. Let's put it to a rap beat and the song still fucking sucks. Like, I don't know. This one's bad, but it's not as
tragic.
Bad. All right. Then we have the Fat Boys.
Yeah.
Who I have you scouring the internet.
We're going to get you.
We'll get you.
You might have to go like a minute in because right. there's like a movie intro for the video.
This is about Freddy also.
Yeah.
They're in like Freddy type sweaters while rapping.
Mm-hmm. I think this was for Nightmare 4.
Ill-fitting Freddy sweaters, I should say. Very similar to the...
Well, play the chorus here.
Okay. Is this what you get down to?
Oof. Nah, yeah. That's a difference between...
Yeah, that's really annoying. All right, so this goes second worst to me so far. So,
all right, so
first is definitely. So then we had Freddy's Greatest Hits.
Yeah, Freddy Krueger had an album.
Yeah, something tells me you had this.
I did not have it.
You lie.
I did.
What's sad, this is not much different than the 86 Mets video. Wait. He's not even singing. He's just laughing in the background.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was going to be like, I'm going to get you in your dreams, little boy. Like, so there's some weird, like, girl singer, and he's just going, ha, 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 ha.
Pretty much that's the whole album. Just somebody sings, and he's like,
I have no words for that.
It's more upbeat than
So are they saying do the Freddy?
Yeah, I guess that's a dance.
Move where you slash people in half. I guess we got to play one more.
I sent you two more.
Well, all right. Well, we'll play two more. So Werewolf Watusi.
Yes, that was also a sequel by our friend Bobby Pickett.
I hate you, Bobby Pickett.
Now gather round, kiddies. I'll tell you something juicy about this dance you call the water.
This sounds like what Harvey Weinstein would probably say. Like this.
Now gather round, kiddies.
I'll tell you something juicy about this dance you call the Watusi. You think it's something new? Well, that's not so. It all really started 400 years ago at a graduation party for Transylvania High back in 1565. We were swaying to the music of Lawrence Wolf and his bubbly bloodthirsty jive.
Getting you in the Halloween spirit?
God, I'm so glad Halloween's over. Let me show you something juicy. Just sit on my lap and see what I write. Okay. I hate that, man. All right, last one. This is called Leprechaun.
In the Hood.
Leprechaun in the Hood.
I come from the land of the Irish Spring. Dublin's the place where I learned my thing. From the Emerald Isle to your place in the hood, I'm the man of green, come to do no good. Lep in the hood, come to do no good. Lep in the hood, come to do no good. What is dope, this place is hype. There's a lassie, she's just my type. I hate your...
Scott, why are you shaking your head?
I lep in the hood.
So soon, madam. Haven't been late so long, it's happened.
They're all so poorly made. It's just like a constant beat in the background. And like has no... It's a lep in the hood. No good.
So the market is still wide open, in your opinion.
I think there's something... I can make something. Maybe for next Halloween, I will have...
2018?
I will have a Scott Brennan original Halloween song. And we'll play it on the show. That means I have about a year to get it done.
I'll write one too.
All right. So tune in next year.
All right, turn off your podcast. Come back in 2018.
No, don't do that, please.
Oh. Yeah, don't do that.
The first one's still the worst to me. The monster rap is so terrible.
It's so cheesy. Yeah. Pretty much the same thing. And it's literally like every 80s white guy who's like, I can rap. It rhymes. It's a rap.
Hey, it's like a lot of these songs remind me of all those sports team songs that we like, hey, we're the Bears, and we never hit. Like, just awful.
Can't touch a flame when it's red hot.
Well, that's a great song. That's not. Yeah. Well, that's not. Let's not shame that song. That song is fantastic. got us to interview a Stanley Cup champion by Jim Poplinski. But let's get to our second guest. This is atrocious. Like, I can't do any better. But let's get it going.
Let's see. Oh.
Do you have fond memories of the circus?
I'm trying to think if I ever went to... I might have went to one circus, but I somewhat... think I did, but I don't really have the memories to back it up, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I remember definitely I went to the circus as a kid, but I don't remember much about it. I remember elephants. I remember, like, it kind of being half empty, and I remember, like, having the colorful things, like the light-up things, but I don't remember...
The glow sticks?
Yeah, like the glow sticks.
Okay.
But other than that, I don't really remember too much else.
Hmm.
But, I guess that's our segue into our guest. That
was smooth.
Our great circus stories that we just shared.
What do you got? Nothing.
I was hoping you had something about like an elephant or you cried at a bat or something that was in the circus.
No, I just cry at magicians and being in a toothbrush outfit. That's about it.
Yeah. I feel like every Halloween you might have to tell the toothbrush story for new listeners because it's just so good.
Yeah,
why don't you tell them real quick?
Oh, okay. Well, I thought we were going into our guests.
We are, but give them the abridged version.
Well, the abridged version is around the third grade, we had a school play, and they drew from a hat, like, different roles, and I was the toothbrush, and I was doing a segment with a girl who was dressed up as teeth. So my mom...
She didn't make out much better than you. I mean, being a tooth isn't... Really?
Well, she was a smiley face before the emoji. She was old school.
Before the ugly toothbrush. The troll music starts playing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So my mom made this costume. They basically took a refrigerator box and cut open holes from it. And they put this big kind of brush thing on the top of it for me. And they put the word crest on the
Did the toothbrush have lines? Did you have lines?
Yeah.
Like, it was, I'll brush you.
Yeah, it was a back and forth. I don't have the script. I'm sorry. I should have kept it.
I picked you like weeks before. Like, I got to nail this toothbrush monologue.
I will put on some toothpaste. God damn it.
Line. I'm a toothbrush. He's a toothbrush. I'm a toothbrush. Trapped in this world. Lost in your mouth.
That's pretty good. We should...
I'm a toothbrush. Did you rinse it on out? I'm a toothbrush. Sorry.
So... so they put me in this costume, and it... The biggest problem was my mom didn't consider I need to actually move my legs back and forth for the hole size on the box.
I hope there was like a brushing scene where you had to like
no.
kneel up and down, like rub the girl in the tooth costume.
Yeah.
Get off of me! You see her Facebook post, me too, in third grade.
30 years later, I'd like to apologize for my actions in the third grade musical
in third
toothbrush.
Grade, in third grade, I was assaulted by a man in a toothbrush costume. Me too.
That's hashtag me too.
Mm-hmm.
But so they open the curtains and we go out and I can't move my legs for nothing. So I'm like waddling up there as the entire audience is just laughing their ass off at me.
He's a toothbrush.
So I start saying my first line and then the girl just starts looking over and laughing at me. She's chuckling and it's pissing me off. So I'm like smacking the tooth costume as I'm trying to get through this and I'm embarrassed and I'm kind of an awkward kid as is.
He's a toothbrush.
So the scenes finally get over. Everybody's laughing. Then we get to the edge of the stage, and I realize I can't walk off the stage. There's no way I can do steps. So the only thing they could do is I had to turn around and basically do a trust fall into two parents as they carried me off of the stage.
The image of that is timeless. Like you, like trying to get off the stage, but like I can't do that. Like, and then just having to like launch your body off, and your dad probably like, oh, God.
No, they were in the back.
Oh, I thought they were the parents catching you.
No, random parents.
Your dad's probably like, I'm gonna go start the car. I'll be out in the car.
Yeah,
and I just picture you like red faced and tears on the way home, like in your toothbrush outfit. Like,
no, I didn't wear the toothbrush outfit home. I got out of it.
Oh, you should have. But yeah, I think Halloween is a good time to relive that story once a year. We'll have to build on it as we go. But let's get to our guest. Who we got?
We got Jonathan Lee Iverson.
Iverson's brother.
No. He's a former member of the Boys Choir of Harlem who traveled all over the world and met different world leaders. And he eventually became one of the ringmasters for Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus.
I am very curious to know how you even, like,
where's the transition?
Do you start at the bottom and like scooping elephant crap and you like work your way up to ringmaster? But hopefully we'll see here.
Hmm.
It definitely should be interesting. So here we go. Hello,
Scott.
Hey, is this Jonathan?
Yes,
Jonathan. Welcome, welcome to the show, man. Thanks for giving us a few minutes of your time.
Oh, no problem.
So, John, where are we calling you from? Where are you at right now? Where are we calling
you from? Right now, I'm at a Boy Scout meeting. I put my son in a Boy Scout, so I'm at his first meeting.
So you're at the meeting right now?
Yeah, no, I had to just step out. I think it just concluded, or it's about to conclude.
He's making one of them Pinewood Derby cars for him right now. He's got to get right back in.
He's like, yeah, I was a ringmaster. First place! But, John, you have a quite an interesting story. I don't know where to start, if we start at your ringmaster days or your Boys Choir of Harlem days, but let's start at the beginning. Were you always into, like, kind of entertaining or presenting or acting or voice work? Where did this all start? Did it start as a kid?
Yeah, out of curiosity. I just wanted to travel. And my mother didn't want to pay for a private school anymore, so it worked out for us both. She found the boys' choir, and it sounded like a great idea. I was about 11. I thought it'd be easy. I thought I'd just join a choir and start traveling. Nobody told me I had to work.
That's how it always
really
goes.
Yeah, I know. It sucks. But it was like... it was really life-changing. I mean, believe it or not, I had to dedicate myself to something. It was, you know, real child-rearing back then. I mean, some of the stuff, you know, they would have done back then, they did it now, they go to jail. You know, like raising your voice.
Yeah, right? Breathing heavily.
Yeah. Ooh, don't raise your voice at a kid. Yeah. So I just started there, and my interest grew. The harder I worked and the more, I guess the harder I worked and the rewards came and, the adventures came and, my interest in, the world of entertainment, I guess, grew, from that. And, you know, I had some extraordinary experiences just when I was a kid. I mean, if I stopped, right there, it would have been good enough, honestly. I was really fortunate. I shared the stage with a lot of really tremendous and legendary entertainers from and diverse set of entertainers from Luciano Pavarotti to Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles. I sang for four presidents and Nelson Mandela when he just was released from prison.
Jeez.
And he made his stop to New York City. And I remember that day it was bone chilling. It was amazing because we'd always heard about him. We learned about him in school and, you know, and he was standing right there and he was free. And we were at the Kennedy airport to greet him. And we sang the South African national anthem for him. And it was just a beautiful moment. And I wasn't even in high school yet. So I had already done a great deal of things, thanks in large part to this tremendous vision called the Boys Choir of Harlem, which was the brainchild of a really terrific man by the name of Dr. Walter J. Turnbull, the late Dr. Walter J. Turnbull. And basically, he created a song of hope in a place that didn't have much back then. I mean, Harlem now looks like, you know, suburbia. It's stunning. It's mind-blowing. But the Harlem I grew up with, I was dipping and dodging and jumping over crack valves. And believe me, back then, with that drug issue, you know, it wasn't a crisis. You know, it wasn't a disease. There was no humanity for those who were wrestling with that addiction and families who were being torn apart. It was really interesting. We had this beautiful song of hope in the backdrop of HIV/AIDS epidemic and the crack era. And, you know, turned out some pretty swell young men.
Oh, that's great. I gotta ask, like, looking over at list and the group of people you talked about, even like looking over like Perry Cuomo and all these people, where I would probably be, you know, tongue-tied just shaking their hand or getting an autograph for him. How's it like to meet some iconic figures and then have to go out there and sing your best where everybody's watching you?
You know, it only worked for those I was really familiar with. You know, that saying youth is wasted on the young is very true. We used to sing with the likes of Tony Bennett like almost every year at the Waldorf Astoria, of all places. I didn't really know who Tony Bennett was, so I didn't really appreciate it. We didn't disrespect him or anything, but it was like nothing. You know what I mean? Perry Cuomo, who was that to me? Now, the people that blew my mind were like Placido Domingo. And, of course, Stevie Wonder. We met him. We did this wonderful concert at Carnegie Hall. It was Stevie Wonder. It was BB and CeCe Winan and Take Six. And James Taylor was there. And it was just like, it was, man, Lena Horne was there. And so, I mean, we were just, I was just starstruck the whole evening. And we did two evenings there. You know, it was the people I was more familiar with. Of course, I was familiar with Pavarotti and, you know, a lot of the classical superstars at that time. And so, you know, that was, you know, in many respects, that was very humbling and life-changing. I mean, when I saw Placido Domingo, I was 13. I was in Japan. And I swear, like, something shifted in my entire mechanism just hearing his voice. I didn't know who he was at the time, but you know, and I remember we were doing a friendship concert for Ronald and Nancy Reagan, and it was in Tokyo, and I was 13 and my voice had just changed. And an older gentleman in the choir came into the dressing room. He said, "Listen, come here, I want you to hear what a real tenor sounds like." And I remember the announcement and everything. He said, "And now, Nancy and Ronald Reagan's favorite tenor, Placido Domingo." Wow. And like, it blew my mind. I mean, I mean, the minute I landed in the States, my brother, you know, he welcomed me back. He said, "Well, what do you want me to get you? You want to give me something?" I guess he made some money. And I said, "Can you give me like a Placido Domingo cassette and a Pavarotti cassette?" And that's what he went and got me. And I must have been the strangest kid in my neighborhood, but it was great because, like, I remember having all of this. I remember I always had a sense of, like, I didn't care, you know, like, I was like the, you know, I think in every, I was the strange, cool kid. Like, I think all of us grew up with that one kid who, like, he's so odd, but he's like the dude.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And unbeknownst to me, I really was that when I look back on it, you know, because I have friends of mine, they were great basketball players and they were doing some wonderful, the typical thing.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, I was kind of a mystery because I was this tall kid. I was, you know, so you tall, you black, you're supposed to be playing ball. I didn't. I was traveling with a boy choir, you know, and so, you know, when you had this one kid giggling, "Oh, what does he do? Sing?" And then the other kid's going, "Yeah, but he's spending his summers overseas. What do you do again?" You know, it's like, "Oh, he was just on TV yesterday." You know, so it's like when you have stuff that validates what you're into and what you're doing, you know, I think it kind of gives you this protective bubble.
Right.
And I think growing up in a, you know, having the privilege of an arts education, which I'm a staunch advocate for, in all, I believe we need arts education everywhere. If you really want to stem bullying, and if you want to really aid young people in overcoming those silly little limits we put on each other, like race and sex and all that stuff, I think the arts is magical in working that out. I went to a high school where you could see the stark difference. There was Martin Luther King High School across the street from us, and it was LaGuardia High School. And I can tell you, Martin Luther King High School did not honor that Martin man's Luther ethics. Yeah. Okay. Now, LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and Performing Arts, you know, you had all of these zany kids who just, you could tell, I mean, you could tell who's like, I mean, just, they weren't even, there was no closet. I mean, they were just out there. But it didn't matter. It was like, man, your talent. And it really was about your person. I mean, there were people with the conservative views, there were people with liberal views. It didn't matter.
Right.
When you're, mm-hmm. It was like you literally could go to lunch with somebody who you were polar opposites with politically, you know, and socially, what have you, and not lose your humanity. I mean, I would have all of these. I had some of the best debates and conversations, deep conversations with some really smart kids. Till this day, I'm like amazed at how bright a lot of my friends were back then. And we're still friends till this day. We may have shifted a little bit, what have you, but you have space, I think, in arts education. You have, you're afforded the ability to grow and to really, really get to know yourself in a very creative way, and thereby getting to know other people. So I was really fortunate in that respect.
Now, when you're with the choir at that age, how often are you guys practice? Is it an everyday type of thing, and is it completely demanding and control of your whole life, or is it like a couple times a week?
Mostly it was. I mean, it was very demanding. I happened to be, I remember when I was in choir, we were really at the height of our ability and popularity, so we were in demand a lot. We even did a Broadway show during 1990, I want to say two or something like that. And it was really demanding, but it was like, it was wonderful. You know, I mean, I was very well aware of the fact that I had a really wonderful existence. It was like living a double life. I was going to school. I'd be in Spanish class one day in Spain the next week. And my Spanish teacher, beautiful woman, and brilliant too, because I literally almost learned Spanish in a semester because of Miss Halpern. And she talked to me with her cigarette voice, and she said, listen, when you go to Spain, I want you to write a report about it and the whole bit. And, you know, so I had those kind of experiences. And so it, even though it was demanding, you know, I go to school and then I go to rehearsal for at least 3 hours after school. And that was just a regular day. It didn't matter if something was coming up or not. One of the great things I respect about my time there was they were adamant about discipline, adamant about preparedness. I mean, you know, when you're a kid, you hate all that stuff. And then, but there's nothing better than seeing the fruits of it, right? That young, when you see the results of it, when you go to other programs, when we go and sing with other programs, we would utterly decimate these other people because mm-hmm. we were so far ahead and so much more equipped. And that was carefully done. It wasn't done to show up other people, but it was really done. Like, if you give children a standard, give them a standard. You know, children aren't porcelain. They're tougher than you think. That's why they're con artists, because they don't really want to do the work. They don't want to really do that stuff. But if you, it's okay to put your foot in their behind every now and then.
Right.
Yeah, this is where, no, this is the standard. But I mean, like, what you have now are just, they're just chump parents. You know, I'm going to be like Bernie Mac. I'll just say, we got some punk-ass parents. And that's what it is. We got punk-ass adults who don't really want to do the work. You know, everybody's, and in a sense, it's like a catch-22. Mm-hmm. We blame the parent, then we take away every tool possible for the parent to be effective. You know, you can't raise your voice. You can't, God forbid, you spank them. God forbid, you know,
right.
All this stuff. So you can't really give the kid a bar to ascend to anything and to go beyond themselves. And, you know, and I think I really believe that's part of the reason why we have so many young people out here who it's crazy. They just have they become desperate because they've never had anyone push them
right
to that point of, you know what, yeah, you can overcome this part of yourself. Yes, you can work hard enough to get here. You can do that. Yeah, you can commit yourself to something and reap the rewards of it. You know, and that was really what the Boys Choir of Harlem did to me. I mean, it was great. I mean, it was like being in this wonderful elite group where you really had to work. I mean, you really had to work. It challenged you. It challenged your manhood, which I think every boy needs. And I mean, it was just, I think it was magical, and it was wonderful for me, at least. You know, I can only speak from my experience, but you know, my experience was also enhanced by the fact that, you know, one of the problems that happens in programs like a Boy Choir or a Boy Scouts or whatever is you have parents who use those organizations as glorified babysitters, right?
Mm.
So 9 times out of 10, the children who get the best out of it are the ones with nosy parents. So,
right.
I was really fortunate. My mother was, I tell her to this day, man, I thank God for her because she was nosy. She was, you know, I had no privacy. She was head of the PTA. She set up PTAs. She was there. She was there with me. So the Boys Choir wasn't like an escape for me. It enhanced what she already laid down. My parents already laid down for me. So it only enhanced that. And that's what these organizations really ideally should be. They shouldn't be saving your kid's life. They shouldn't have to save your kid's life and do all that stuff. And if it is, then there's something deeply troubling going on in society that has to be remedied.
Yeah. So you went through all this stuff. You traveled the world with the choir. You had the good teaching in LaGuardia, and you went to Hartford. When you get into your 20s and you realize you got to go out on yourself, is there any kind of part of you that says, all right, I've been through this, it'll be easy? Or is there any kind of letdown kind of saying, all right, I've already accomplished all of this. Is there any way to go still up from here?
You know, it was funny because my plan, I did have a plan, and the plan was to go to Europe and further my studies as an opera singer. And that was the plan. I was going to do that. So I was just looking to raise some money during that summer that I graduated college. I really didn't want to go to graduate school, but I wanted to go. I found a wonderful instructor, and I figured, oh, well, I'll go to Europe. And, you know, I'll just live there for a while and really do like a work study type of thing, you know? And in the midst of that is when I found, in the midst of the hustle for that, is when I ran smack into Ringling Brothers, you know. And, you know, I always think my life has always worked that way in a sense. You know, I have these funny plans and I have a dream or something, and, you know, God one-ups me, you know. So, you know, I guess you could do the vision board stuff, and I guess, what do you say, the law of attraction? I don't know. But I think I sort of live with the law of, if you essentially get to the business of whatever it is that stirs in you, if you're just on your job, you know, whatever that thing is in you, it's really not your business to wonder how or when or in what form it's going to come. You know, I truly believe in that Matthew 6:33 passage. It says, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. It makes sense. I think most people are basically having psychological heart attacks every day because they're so immersed in just getting by, having to pay those bills. And I get it. so we don't really know how to walk on water. We're busy looking at all the things, I guess, the supposed obligations, the fears, the storms that are around us, rather than focusing ourselves on really what it is we want to do. And somewhere in me, I think, really early, and I was really fortunate because I think, and I credit my mother for it, you know, I think she's a social engineering genius because, you know, she really facilitated a type of home where I was able to dream like that. And then she would go, okay, well, you're going to dream like that. Well, what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And there was an active pursuit of it. And so that told me I had permission to not just be, but to really be what I am, you know, yeah. because I saw it. I mean, I saw horror stories when I got to college. Like, it was habitual to run into people who were literally pursuing degrees that they didn't want to, but, you know, they were either scared.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or they had parents who discouraged what was in them. When I joined Ringling Brothers, one of my favorite things was to go around to schools, and I'd speak to a lot of students, especially in music and arts programs. And without fail, I'd always get a group of kids coming to me saying, you know, I hear you, but, you know, I really want to do this. And my parents are like, well, you know, I should be practical and do this. And, you know, one of the things I tell people, I heard Spike Lee say it, and I think it's true. You know, parents are dream killers. You know, some of the people, it's crazy. Like, the very people that'll kill your dream are the closest to you. Right. It's not even the haters. You can deal with the haters. You see them coming. But the people you live with, because they do it in quote unquote love.
Right.
Like, they really 100%. Mean well. Yeah. Right. They mean well. They really do. Especially like immigrant families. I noticed that too. Like a lot of immigrant families. My father was an immigrant. So my father, it was a strange thing for him to hear about me wanting to be an entertainer. I mean, he's an immigrant from Trinidad. That's not a real thing.
Right.
You know, most right. immigrant families are like that. And I understood. Culturally speaking, you know, I mean, let's just be real. Most of our businesses in this country are set up by immigrants. And so they have a practical understanding and they have appreciation in the sense of the American opportunity right. than most Americans do. So I get what that means. But I always found I had to fight harder through people's caring objections than I ever had to do with, you know, some hater. That was easy. That was like fuel, you know. But I'll never forget this. Before I went to college, this was the thing that really cemented what I believed in myself. I'll never forget it. I had these teachers, and they were all wonderful people. All wonderful people. And they knew I was going to go and study music. Now, each and every one of these teachers were musicians. And they all told me, you know, just make sure you have the backup. Make sure you got the backup. You know, this may not work out. And the thing I was glad, this is when your youthful arrogance actually worked. Because in my mind, I was like, but you're all doing your B plan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're all frustrated musicians.
Mm-hmm.
You're all just doing what you basically...
The safety
you
net.
Went, yep. Yeah, you went with your side chick. Because that's what the safety net is.
Yeah, yep.
You went with your, you know, your dreams are jealous. They're jealous.
Right.
And they won't be shared. And that's not saying you shouldn't have practical skills. I think you should. I think in this day and age especially, you know, one of my beliefs is that, you know, there is an evolutionary jump happening in the workforce and how we're going to be living in the next 5 to 7 years. And I think if you don't know how to interact with people who are different than you, I think if you don't have a basic grasp of technology, I think, and I honestly think if you aren't bilingual, you're going to have a hard time. I think that's why you see all of these breakouts of, you know, where they had the White Lives Matter march the other day. And what that is fear. Mm-hmm. That's just fear. It's funny. Yeah. And for some reason, right? So I thought my mother was crazy when she introduced me to this lady, this lady's theory. But I don't know if you ever heard of her. Her name is Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, the late Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. And she had a really thorough, she's a brilliant woman. She studied the dynamics of race and white supremacy. She really spent her life studying it. And the theory that she came up with was just mind-blowing. And it's in her book, The ISIS Papers. And a lot of what, if you ever read that book, you know, listeners ever read that book, and I think it should be required reading, I really do, you will see a lot of the stuff playing out exactly as she pointed out. Mm-hmm. A lot of this stuff is fear. It's just fear.
Right.
I mean, it's a fact. I mean, the so-called opioid crisis, it's much bigger than people than it's being reported.
Yep.
It's literally a state of emergency in many states. When you think about the reality that more white people are dying than being born, I think in Spain, they just appointed a sex minister because people aren't having babies. Wow. So in that mindset, it's a survival mindset. And so it's, mm-hmm. I don't even know if it's so much a hatred for other people as it is this fear where you just want to survive. And a lot of people are walking around in some sense with that mindset. So while they're whining, you can do one of two things. You can either choose to evolve or get swallowed up. Choose to evolve or get swallowed up. The world's going to change. It's going to spin.
Yep.
It's, you know, one of the things, you know, a lot of people when, you know, we were in, when I was in a circus and we dismissed the elephants. You know, and I mean, it was like the backlash was swift.
Right.
And we did suffer in ticket sales. And I really believe that was the beginning of the end. And I knew it would be. But the lesson I got in that, and I understood, it wasn't just business. The reality is change is the only constant. Hmm. And, most of us don't like it, especially when we're comfortable with things, especially those things we've taken for granted. But it is one of those things you really have to be cognizant of. And I think it's one of those skill sets that makes for great leaders. Great CEOs, great leaders, they have to literally have a foresight to what's going on. And I think on a personal level, in our own personal lives, we have to have that going. I think it is a good thing, not only to identify what it is you do and what it is you do well, that thing that makes your blood beat, as James Baldwin would put it, but also to kind of think outside your box, too. You know, give yourself that space because, you know, I mean, that's how I see it. I foresee there is a leap going on. There's growth going on. And it's one of the reasons why I decided to join this new opera company out here in Orlando, Opera del Sol. It's very new. In fact, we're going to have our first production this November. And the idea behind it is really wonderful and is something that the performing arts community has been craving. A arts institution that really takes opera beyond the opera house and really brings it to the audience of the 21st century. Well, you know,
it's funny you said that. Right before you came on, we had Aisha Ash on, who was a African-American ballerina, and we were just kind of talking about the same exact kind of thing, like taking something like ballet, which, you know, you picture, you know, let's be honest, you picture rich, stuffy white people going to see it in a theater, and it's so set in one way for centuries. And then we were talking with her how how is ballet evolving and bringing it into you know, a modern area, bringing it into urban areas, bringing it into where there's a new audience. And she was saying the same thing, like, you know, they're trying different music, and she's in a program that's trying to bring it to inner city. So it's kind of interesting to hear you talk about something very different but similar at the same time.
No, you know, the reality is, one thing I discovered, one of the great gifts of the boys choir was that, you know, you don't really have to. One of the things I hate when, and I get why they do it, but, like, you know, when a lot of these new institutions or older ones, they're trying to relate to millennials or urban audiences or what have you, you know, they almost feel that what they have, they think the mistake is they think their product is not relatable to them.
Right.
So somehow they're under the illusion that, oh, if we put some hip hop in it, the kids get it. Or we do this.
Yep.
You know, the reality is, to me, it's condescending. And two, you're cheapening, not to say hip hop is, you're cheapening both crafts.
Right.
Right? I mean, I think one of the most brilliant uses of hip hop I've ever seen was just recently in musical theater with the boom of Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
The way he used hip hop for that brilliant musical that he created. And the music's amazing. And the story's amazing. At bottom, you have to have a great story.
Yep.
But the way he used it was in a recitative style. And you're telling the story. I don't care what genre it is. It could be country. It could be rock and roll. It could be opera. People want a great story. The reason why country music, they're always selling like crazy is because they're great stories. You know, they tell great stories. Ray Charles said that when he did his country music album and everybody thought it was going to flop and it became like the number one album in America.
Yep.
He said the reason why it works is because the stories. People like good stories. People will always like good stories. And I think it's really just the responsibility of any arts institution is, okay, well, how do we repackage this story to tell it? You know, how do we tell it in a new way that could probably captivate the audience? There's a lot of wonderful operas out there with some tremendous stories that maybe, okay, maybe for the 21st century audience, a setting in the 1600s may not really jive with them. But let's say you took something like Verdi's Otello, okay? Now, it's based, of course, on the famous Shakespearean play. Now, let's say you did that, but you updated it. Let's say Otello is not merely a Moorish warrior and he's in love with his Mona. Let's say he's a football player. You can play on all of these. Make him an athlete.
Yep.
Yeah.
Make him an athlete. Just twist the whole thing. Modernize it in a sense. You know, you can shade the stories. I mean, and you can do it with musicals as well. I mean, imagine you take the story of Les Miserables, which will probably play forever. It's been around, 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
You could take that story. Imagine taking Les Mis and setting it in apartheid South Africa. Or be even more dramatic, set it in Ferguson, Missouri. Don't touch the music.
Right.
Don't touch it. Because believe me, that story is universal.
Right.
And it is timeless. If you go to any people group anywhere around the world who's ever had to deal with oppression, you will see it, that the themes are all the same. The themes are all the same. Well, thank you.
Yeah, man.
Can you hold on for a second?
Yeah, no problem.
He doesn't have any peanut butter in it, does he?
Oh, thank you. Hello.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry. Yeah.
You know, the themes are all the same. So I think the challenge a lot of performing arts has, I don't think, you know, they should ever, I don't think they should really, they don't really have to do much to what they have, because the stuff is timeless. The music is timeless. The stories are timeless, and they are universal. It's just I think, how do you approach the new audience? You know, just how do you approach them? And that should really be the challenge. And also, at the root of it is most of us, I don't care if it's in the poorest section of our country, 1 in 5 people live under the poverty line, or if it's in the 1%, we're not exposing people to a robust arts culture, arts education. It's not mandatory. And so as a result, you know, I think a lot of us really don't even know what to look for. They don't even know what to listen to. They don't even, you know, we're not having that part of ourselves cultivated. And I think that is problematic in many respects, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. It's just not being cultivated.
Right.
And if it's not being cultivated, I think, of course, a lot of these wonderful works and things tend to look a bit, naturally, they look rather unfamiliar, you know, and we tend to marginalize what we don't know, or we even romanticize it, too. You know, I mean, when I was in college and I was studying opera, and, you know, it was always fascinating to me to, you know, I'd be with some of my colleagues, and it just always fascinated me how they had this very snobbish attitude when it came to the classics. Like, they were almost above everything else. I remember we were doing this exercise in the opera scenes class, and I was assigned this particular song, and I'll never, the name of the song was called En Sourdine, which means in secret.
Okay.
And it was a French song. And I remember looking up the translation, and can you hold on for a second? I remember the song in its translation basically was a beautiful poem by a young man who was trying to entice a woman.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to entice this woman to come away with him. That was his whole bit. And the way he was doing it, I mean, you know, the poetry, it was so lovely, but at bottom, he was just trying to get his rocks off.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, I was able to see, wow, this is like, there's a universality to this stuff.
Mm.
And so when my professor was asking me, she said, well, what does this make you think of? I said, honestly, it makes me think of Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On. Now, the snobs in the class, oh gosh, they were so offended.
Mm-hmm.
And she laughed and she said, you know, actually, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, they're saying the same thing, you know. Somebody may say it a little crass. Somebody may say it with more subtlety. But, it, you know, it's kind of like politics, you know. I mean, the best politicians just know how to say what they want in a certain way, you know. I mean, it could be just as destructive or just as wonderful, but they just know how to say it, you know. And that's what it comes down to. So I think... In many respects, what will advance the performing arts once again will be arts education for all. And I hope, you know, there's a reinvestment in that. I think it's a vital thing. I think it's just as vital as STEM education and things of that nature. And it's been proven to be. And also a more creative, more risk-taking directors, artistic directors, executives who actually run these institutions, who are willing to, you know, step out of the box. And part of it is, too, their funders are old money. Yeah. So, you know, that's a big part of it. You know, old money, you know, some of those folks, they just want things a certain way. And that's why when you go to certain opera houses, they're doing the same old thing. Mm. They're doing the same old thing. They don't want to see anything else but Tosca. And they want it the way they saw it back in 1947. You know, it's like, okay, you know, and that's in many respects why you have this sort of nervousness occurring in the performing arts. But I think with organizations like Opera del Sol and others, I think you're going to see an evolutionary leap occur in the performing arts, where it will have to grow and there will have to be different things and different ways of doing it.
Awesome.
Yeah, that'd be great. Let me bring you back to your circus days. I read an article where you talked about how you got a letter, how a person was going to commit suicide, and they saw the circus, and they chose not to kill themselves afterwards. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, it was strange. I got a letter from a person by the name of Kelsey. It was Charleston, West Virginia. And, they wrote me, and it was written by hand. And basically, this person claimed that, you know, I'm sorry?
No, that was the dog.
Okay. No, the person claimed that, they'd come to the show. It was about the time where we were having the last few shows with the Elephants. They'd come to say bye to the Elephants. And, you know, and they were going to, you know, that was going to be it.
Right.
And they just want to say bye to the Elephants. That would be it. And then during the process of the show, somehow watching Alexander Lacy, who was the tiger lion trainer then, watching him with his lions and tigers, I guess it triggered something in this person where they said, you know, I saw how he was able to approach them and handle them. I thought of my problems like that, and I figured, well, maybe I can deal with my problems like that. Like, I don't have to just give up. And it was just a real basic thing. And he just said, I want to thank you, you know, and hopefully I'll be able to, you know, do for somebody what the show did for me. That's, you know,
you never know, right?
Yeah, you know, you don't. It's like, it was just like, you know, I'm thinking we just sell popcorn, cotton candy, and sawdust streams, you know? Yeah. And you just never know what that means. I met a mother in Jacksonville. I mean, this woman, her and her two kids, they were having too good of a time in the front row, and I had to meet them because they just were like, I mean, having a blast. And I went over there, and they jumped me with hugs. It was like, and the mother, lovely lady, and she looked me in my face. She said, you know, this show means so much to us because my son over here, he's autistic. Well, he didn't speak for his first 4 years. The first time he spoke was here at Ringling Brothers.
Wow.
And so we have to keep coming. And I'd heard other stories from some clowns who would tell me about, like, other autistic children who come to the show, and their experience there really gave them a sense of normalcy. You know, they came out of their shell, or whatever their spectrum of autism was. It really didn't have much of an effect when they were at the circus, you know. And so it was really fascinating. You know, I would think, wow, there's some kind of magic there.
Connection, but, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, I've been wondering this. When you go to, I don't even know if you apply or audition for the circus, did you start like at the bottom? Were you like working, cleaning up after the elephants?
Right at the top.
You just started right as the first yeah. ever African-American ringmaster right off the bat.
Yeah, right
it's
off
amazing.
The top.
Now, yeah. Tell us what goes into, like, okay, we see the ringmaster. We think of him like in movies and TV. But what goes into that job? What are they looking for? Obviously, you're an entertainer, but there's got to be so much to it. And we think of the circus life and hear about it. But give us a little insight into what that job actually entails. Like, what's your responsibility?
Well, aesthetically, you do have to have some kind of presence. Obviously, you should be vocally substantial.
Right.
I think the biggest thing is endurance and having a supple mind, because you will, one of the things I will say, and I guess I have to update my resume with this. I realized it today. I was like, wow, I could be in crisis management. Because, you know, you really do. You have to just, you have to, you really have to have an understanding of the ebbs and flows of a show that is living,
right?
Like a Ringling Brothers show is. I mean, it's just alive. And so things happen for better or worse that were always constantly happening, where you really had to think on the fly.
Right.
And you couldn't, you know, you couldn't freeze up. You know, I've had, you know, wonderful occurrences happen, you know, in the middle of a show. I've had would-be disasters turn into beautiful moments that we talk about. You know, I remember the power went out right in the middle of a, fortunately, it didn't happen during an animal act, but it went out right in the middle of one of our parade numbers. And, you know, we kept the choreography going the whole bit. And, but what was beautiful about it was the song was so, it was one of those where you could really sing along to them. So the audience basically knew it after a few verses. And so the entire arena was singing along.
That's awesome.
And then when the power came back up, believe it or not, everybody was on the beat.
That's funny.
And it, you know, so you know, it's one of those, the show must go on. I've been in the middle of devastation, you know. You know, I've actually seen friends, you know, have terrible accidents. You know, and I, that's his own kind of trauma, because you know, in circus, you're not just with a coworker. You're literally with family. These are people you live with. And, you know, you always have in the back of your head that any one of these shows could be their last show, you know. And, you know, I lived that. I've dealt with that. I fortunately didn't have to deal with a death, but it was close enough.
Right.
Oh, man. To see people you love, their lives change in a blink of an eye, where, you know, one minute they can fly and then they can't do it anymore. You know, and having to deal with that and having to maintain a sense of
professionalism.
Yeah, professionalism and calm.
Right.
And a bit of the fantasy for the audience's sake, even if they realize what's going on. But you still have to be that calm in the storm, so to speak. You know, I've been through those too, and you just have to know how to deal with it. And then you have to know how to care for yourself. Self-care is a major thing if you're going to be a ringmaster. You really have to have self-care. Because it's easy to neglect yourself to a degree. You know, it's very easy to neglect yourself because you're just going and going.
Right.
And it's just easy to just forget to really take care of your mechanisms, because you do feel strong because you're doing it so much. The voice is a muscle, and just the habit of doing it, you know, you can fall in the illusion of how do you say, you can fall in the illusion of doing things by rote,
right?
You know, and what that can do. But you really have to focus on growing yourself. And so one of the things I did, I made the gym a part of my routine. I always worked out a lot just to give my body a new routine. And I always took voice lessons too. Because, you know, the voice is a muscle of your body, just like your body, it keeps growing. And, you know, there are new things about it, you know, experiences and all those sorts of things. And that was a really priceless thing for me when I was in a circus, and it allowed me to evolve when I needed to, And I really believe if I didn't do certain things, I would have probably ruined myself.
Right.
You've been very in-depth. There's a lot of stuff we talked about today. We really appreciate it. So I got to throw out a stupid question here. Did you guys still have circus trains when you were doing it? And if so, can you get any privacy in those things?
I also want to piggyback on that. You guys said you're a big family. Was there like any rivalries between the clowns and the ringmaster and the trainers? Like, was there a hierarchy? Was there gangs, or did you guys
there wasn't a hierarchy. You know, I mean, people naturally gravitated to certain groups, and there was certain personality. Everybody always knew the clowns were crazy. They're going to do the craziest stuff. And you ran from them during your birthday because they were going to pie you. The thing that always
don't go out drinking with the clowns. You'll never come back.
The people who get you drunk were the Russians. I used to hate it. I'd be out, I'd be out all night or something. And then I come home and I got to walk through the train yard. And then I'm like, crap, because Russians be out there barbecuing. And you cannot go by a Russian and not drink something. They're going to make you. I mean, these are world-class acrobats who, they're one finger deadly. So they can, you're going to drink something. Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, so whatever. Even a ringmaster, nobody cared. It was like, well, you come on, you got to do, come on, so it's like, okay.
Vodka.
So you have to drink, it's one of those things. So, it was kind. Nobody ever got their arm broke. The thing that always freaked me out that was funny to me was the clowns never, ever had a problem. Ever, ever had a problem. Getting girlfriend, women loved it. And it would kind of piss me off because I was like, wait a minute.
I'm the ringmaster.
What? Exactly. That's what I thought. Nah, man, these clowns, man. I don't know. Maybe it was the shoes. But it was like, clowns? I don't know. I guess because they just had that kind of thing about them where, I don't know, they just didn't care. So they were crazy enough,
That might be the name of this episode, Clowns Are Womanizers.
I don't think you'll hear about them in the news. Everything was consensual as far as I know. Did I pass? Yeah, but other than that, it was... no rivalries really. No, the animal people. No, I will say that there was always rivalries. the beauty about being a ringmaster is the beauty about being a ringmaster for me was that it fit with my personality where I was alone a lot. So I could, I was always. I would say I was always I had an objective view. Mm-hmm. You're almost like the interim camp counselor.
Gotcha.
right.
I would hear everybody's problems. I would hear everybody's problems. I've taken stuff to my grave. I can't even put it.
That's awesome.
But it was great because, you're by yourself. I didn't have troop problems. I didn't have troop problems to deal with. That was the best part for me. The train... Also, I loved living on the train. Absolutely loved living on the train. It was the best thing. It was like a mini vacation after a hard work week. Because, just the motion of it, being able to see, to be able to enjoy the country in that manner. You get to see America go by.
Right.
It's just absolutely beautiful, absolutely astonishing. And it really was the best part for me. And I had a private car. I like to say I used to live in the suburbs of the train. So, you know, I had a half a car. It was me and my family.
Oh, you know, really?
Yeah, my family traveled with me. My wife was a production manager.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And my children, in my last tour, my children ended up being hired to be in the show as well.
Huh.
So it was great. Like, everybody was getting paid, you know.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's one of them things where I'm, like, eternally you know, people say what they want about the Fell family who own Ringling Brothers, and I'm not hearing it. I'm not having it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think what they gave to most people who can't, if you were in a Ringling Brothers show for more than 4 years, you certainly got more out of it than what you came in with. Mm. You know, I came in, I was broke, I was bachelor, I left with a family, you know, and I mean, and the experiences are just beyond compare. I mean, it's really one of those things where often it's hard to explain to the uninitiated because it's just such a, it's like going right to the land of Oz, you know? I mean,
it's like a fraternity, like you know, like you don't know the inside of it.
Yeah, it's even more than, it's really a family in many respects. It's this quirky, dynamic family of very different people who discovered their common humanity again through the arts.
Right.
Through the arts, you know. I think there's something to be said, especially about the circus arts. I mean, you really don't have time to think about race and gender and who somebody's going to bed with when you're 48 feet in the air
or getting pied in the face.
Yeah. Right. Like, you just want them to catch you.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you have that interdependence on another human being, and when you're around each other so much where you get to really see each other's contributions, whether it be the ringmaster or whether it be the crew person,
mm-hmm.
There's a real appreciation for the dignity of work, and the dignity of literally coming together and making your contribution to something wonderful and that you know is wonderful, that you know does something for the lives of others. I think it's priceless.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, not like I've been lying this whole time, but I don't know why people use the term. Be honest with you. You know,
it'd be great if you just ended this. Be honest with you. I hate the fucking clowns.
Yeah, right. I've been lying this whole time, but I'm going to tell the truth there. You know, when I first heard the news of, you know, the show closing, I was not at all concerned for myself. I wasn't concerned at all about, oh, my goodness, I'm not going to have a job doing what I really love anymore. Of course, that was a slight concern. I already kind of saw that coming, but I really, like, my heart went out to circus fans.
Mm-hmm.
It went out to the future that will never see that again. Right. Like, you know, they're not going to get that again. You can't get that in any other form of entertainment but circus.
Mm.
Like, you can't get it anywhere. People ask me, you know, what are you going to do next? Is it going to be just as thrilling? No. Steven Spielberg could call me tomorrow. And yes, I will take the check. But, you know, there's nothing out there. There's nothing. I don't care what anybody said. Nobody. I don't care what they tell you. There's nothing out there. Nothing.
I'm going to be on a podcast called Verbal Shenanigans. Where do you think it's going from here?
Of course.
John, thanks so much for coming on. Like, I just had these images of you, the clowns, and like you waking up from a hangover, like, damn clowns again. You know, like,
why did I go to that Russian barbecue? No.
Clown and the Russians can't stay away from them. But, so thanks for giving us, like, very, very insightful. And a common thread between your time from the choir to the Ringling Brothers stuff to just the arts in general. So yeah, the opera and just arts in general. So you have a very, very good outlook on it. And I like that you have very like opinion, very opinionated and very well thought out responses. So before you go, is there anywhere that fans or people who hear this or people want to check you out that they could go see some of your work or say hi or see what you're up to?
Yeah, you know, they're always welcome to visit me on my at my website, bigtopvoice.com, which is my handle, my Twitter handle. It's my Facebook fan page handle. You know, you can follow me that way. You know, it's not as exciting because I'm an unemployed ringmaster, but, you know, I mean, you know, life is going on and there's some good things happening, where I'm at now. Especially working with Opera Del Sol.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think people will be, pleasantly surprised, in the near future. It's funny, I just got cast in a play at the Garden Theater here in Orlando. And you know, it's just one of these, it's like I'm in the midst of recreating myself. I'm actually in the midst of writing my book.
Okay. Yep.
Which is a tedious task. I mean, writing sucks, but it's beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah, so
chapter 13, the Russians.
Yeah.
But that's awesome, man. Thanks so much for coming on and giving us a lot of time. Good luck with everything you have in the future here. Interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
It's
I'm glad we got that at the end and all the insight to the circus
yeah.
life.
Yeah, I can't. I feel like it's just, I remember I read this book called Water for Elephants, I think it was called. They made it into a movie, and it was kind of like, they made it into like a love story. Or whatever, but it was, the book was like really well written, and it was about like living in the circus and like being on the circus train and all the crazy things and the drunks on the train and the performers. And it, but it took place in like, I don't know, the 30s or 40s. It's probably when the circus was really like insane, you know, like probably like no rules. But
yeah, that's when like the circus was like the thing.
Right. It was coming to town.
It's like, oh my God, it's coming to town. Party. We gotta go there.
Yeah. And I remember that's just what I picture in my mind. I remember being very let down by the movie, though. It's with, I don't know who's in it. I forget. But I tried to watch. I'm like, this isn't what I read.
Yeah.
But
well, we had this interesting story, but we need to get 14-year-old girls into this movie. So. Yeah,
exactly. Ruin everything. All right. Very common thread between both our guests tonight. There's definitely like a common undertone of like the arts and it being some of the first or, you know, and
kind of moving the meter, if you will, kind of right. into today's time.
Right. And also being African-American and being like a ballerina, like that's not common at all. Being African-American, and being a ringmaster, the first ever, you know, it's funny how like there's a common thread between the two of them. They're both very, very well thought out and very they've probably been asked a lot of the same questions a million times, so you could see where they...
So we're not doing our job, basically.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I asked them about circus trains. Come on now.
But we... Nice long episode, but we got to get out of here, Berlus. Yep. So, anything to promote?
I'll just do my page, facebook.com/theburl721. We're ending up pumpkin spice whatever this week. Probably when this out, it's over. But I will be continuing with Tonight on The Walking Dead. I'm going to be working on a couple of things. Going to put some more material out onto the site. So facebook.com/theburl721.
All right. And I will just promote next Wednesday. So this will probably come out. So it'll be a week from today if you're listening to it. I'm doing my first show at Paragon Tap and Table with the one and only Mark Riccadonna, and joining us is our good friend Mike Ciccoli and Jackie Byrne. So,
oh, all great comedians.
This
right
would be
there.
A very good show. So
always.
We'll see. And I guess that's it. Let's thank our guest Aisha Ash and Jonathan Lee Iverson. You guys, what you can do is share the podcast.
Yep.
Listen to the podcast.
Yep.
Rate the podcast.
Very high.
Comment on the podcast.
Yep.
Buy a shirt from the podcast.
Yeah.
Follow us on Instagram. Sure. Follow us on Twitter.
Yep.
Follow us on Facebook.
Yes.
But if you do just one of those things, it would be listen to it. Okay. Listen to the podcast. Yeah. Check it out. Go back. Check out some of the guests we've had. This year has been pretty incredible, if we don't say
insane
so ourselves.
Insane to say the least.
But that's what you can do. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
Let's go.
Not too often we go out on Britney Spears.
There's only two types of people in the world. Tell us, Britney. The ones that entertain, uh-huh. And the ones that observe. Oh. Oh, baby, I put on a show kind of girl. Don't let the back seat, gotta be first.